Hello, and thank you for joining us for the RealCom webinar. Today we will be talking about AI and machine learning. My name is Sarah Bemperat with RealCom, and I'm very fortunate to have a great panel of thought leaders joining me today. Before we get started, I want to go over a few housekeeping items. You can use the Q&A section to submit your questions and comments for the panelists. And for the best webinar experience, we recommend that you log out of any other internet applications that are currently running. If you need any help during the webinar, you can contact me at sbemperat@realcom.com or just leave me a chat. And we will also be recording the session and we'll be sending out a copy of the recording within the next few days. This webinar is sponsored by our gold sponsors, Brainbox AI and Cherry, and we'll learn more about these companies throughout the session. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to the moderator for today's event, Abby Shockley. Dr. Abby Shockley has a PhD in physics and has been working as a data scientist for B2C companies for the past 5 years. She came to RPT Realty, an open-air shopping center REIT, to serve as their enterprise data manager, where she's responsible for all things data strategy. She hopes to leverage her extensive experience modeling customer interactions into the world of real estate data. So thank you very much, Abby, for joining us, and I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Sarah, for the introduction. It's really great to be here today, kicking off the data analytics and AI machine learning series. I've been doing this for a while, and like Sarah said, I started in the B2C industry. So it's really like about 5-10 years ago, data really started kicking off because there's just so much more that people can collect today. And it started to become more of a conversation about how do we turn our data into an asset that can help drive our company's strategy and make us better. And how do our data assets help us, you know, beat the competition, give us that edge that lets us do things that other people aren't. And so in the B2C world, there's just been this explosion of technology. My last job, I was at a marketing tech firm, and there's probably 10,000 different analytics options to choose from if you're in marketing. So it's really interesting to be in the real estate world because I would say right now we are just starting to kick off like all these prop tech companies coming into the world and saying, how can I help you with your AI, with your data analytics, making better presentations? And from the perspective of, you know, being a data professional, I always think, and we talk about this a lot at RPT, it's how do you define your business goals? How do you make sure that you know what your company is trying to solve with data before you really start down that data journey? Because if you're not clear on your strategy, you can end up being, there's a quote somewhere that like 90% of data projects fail. You can be part of that number. So it's really important to go in with your hat on of just because someone asked for it doesn't mean that's the right way to go. And let's try to think about this strategically. And so I think what we're going to hear a lot from our speakers is how does that work today in various sections of the real estate industry? So how do we have people who work for real estate companies? What are they doing? How are they solving these data problems within the real estate industry? And then from our vendors, how can they help you solve problems that you might have? And so you can go back to your business and say, hey, I think this would be useful, and start building out good business cases. Because I would say the hardest part about being a data professional is you have to straddle that line between, I am very technical, but I also need to know the business. And I think more than most other IT professionals, it's the superpower that we have is being able to understand what are the business needs and talking to our business stakeholders and translating their ideas into a technology solution that is that can be a differentiator for your business. So now if I have a little bit more time to talk, I didn't even take up that much of my time. So I can say for RPT, some of the stuff that we look at, since we are an open air shopping center, we really want to get in the heads of how retailers are approaching what they're doing for their business. So for us, it's not just the real estate fundamentals of, you know, are we getting our good ABR per square foot? How are we, what's our occupancy at? How are we continuing to fill our centers? But it's also bringing in outside things like, you know, in this new world, we have to talk a lot about ESG and climate change. How does that affect what we're doing as a real estate business? We have to talk, we talk a lot about what does traffic look like to our centers? How can we think like a retailer when we're trying to attract new tenants? And how can we think like a retailer when we're trying to figure out what's important to our businesses so that they're getting, our tenants are getting the traffic and the needs that they have to continue to support their business? And then how do we go out and use what we've learned about our own internal systems? How do we drive that to help grow our business, whether that be through going into acquisitions or just leasing up centers that we already have, or, you know, putting together really compelling leasing packages to send over to our customers about, you know, here's what we think, why we think RPT is the right place for you to be as a retailer. And I would think for a lot of you in the real estate industry, those are the kinds of hats you're putting on, is how do I think like an office tenant? How do I think like a retailer? You know, how do I think like somebody who wants to come rent a space? And that's where I would say, like in the real estate industry, we're probably a little bit more at a disadvantage because we don't have access to the same level of detail that our B2C partners have. And they don't always want to share their information with us either, because it's to their competitive advantage that they have that information advantage on us. So without that, all that being said, I think I'd like to introduce our next speaker. So our first speaker today is Ilan Zakhar from Carr Properties. And Ilan Zakhar, he's currently the CTO at Carr Properties, a privately held REIT known for its portfolio of trophy quality properties in the Washington, D.C. area. For over 20 years, Ilan has been an executive business leader and innovative technology strategist for multinational real estate and property development companies worldwide. Ilan, I'm going to turn the floor over to you now.
Thank you very much, Abby. Thank you for having me too. A little bit about Carr Properties, and then I'll get a little bit into the weeds of the analytics and what we're doing over here. Carr Properties is it's a privately held owner operator of commercial real estate office buildings in Metro DC, Boston, and now we also have an asset in Austin, Texas. We grow through development. We have 4.4 million square feet, and 2.4 million is in development and construction right now. One of the things that I want to talk today about is, before we get into the AI and we get into the machine learning, I think that the analytics side of it is also very intriguing, but the data, it all comes down to the data, and what do we do with the data? How do we collect the data? And also, what is important when we get to the data? And I think that, you know, when we think about it, when we talk about these projects and we have to present them to our management, it's very much, if we build it, it will come, because we can't really show anything day one about this, about these projects. So we have to start with the big data, which pretty much equates to big picture, and at the end of the day also equates to bigger things. So this is where, you know, where we have to sell to our management, to our executives, and to get the buy-in in order to start this. So when we look at our data, and we looked at our analytics project within Carr Properties, we really were tackling four different hurdles that we were looking at. The first one is how do we bring everything to a single pane of glass? Because we're not replacing the existing systems. We're not replacing the facility management. We're not replacing the BMS system. We're not replacing our energy management. We're not replacing any of these systems, but we want to take the data out of these systems and decouple it so we can manage it and we can do much more with it. The second thing we want to do is we want to bring this data and normalize it across systems and normalize it within its own system. For example, we today manage data, we collect data from four different access control systems. Well, every access control system labels things differently, identifies things differently. So you have to sort of like get to a normalization or how to bring all of these pieces of data, all these different same systems, access control, into one master table and be able to then use the data afterwards somewhere else. But if we want to mix data access control with facility management or with occupancy counters, then the data from the different systems also has to have some link between it. So that was our second problem that we had to address and had to resolve. The next thing is, how do we move the data, or how would you use the data in order to make it useful? So because we decouple the data, because we keep the data outside of the actual applications, it's easier for us today to attach third-party systems to be able to read from this data and be able to leverage it. So for example, we're using Okapi, which is one of our partners that we work with. And I know that James will talk about it too, that Okapi allows us to take this data and provide us a sentiment analysis or even a customer risk component. We'll talk about it and I'll show you some screens later. The other thing is also, how do we leverage the data and make it actionable and usable? So for example, during COVID, our access control data was very useful for us. We negotiated with our cleaning company within the buildings that if specific companies don't occupy their space during that day or are not coming in, then there is no need to clean that space. And if you didn't know, garbage removal is the most expensive part in the cleaning process. So if you don't have to go in and remove garbage because the people are not there, then they were not going to bill you for that day. The last piece was, how do we now take the data and we leverage it for automation, or we leverage it for other components? And when we talk about automation, I'm going to talk a little bit about more what type of things we're doing over here. But now, apart from the data being actionable, we can actually put the data to work and even within our buildings and do a lot of things for us. So this is, you know, when we talk about the landscape of a building, the nervous system of our building, you can even consider the building almost like a living, breathing entity. It feels, it senses, it identifies things. You pull things from it, you bring things into it. So it is very important that we understand how our buildings operate and all of the data that are inside. Now, data is data. So it's very important that you actually look at the pieces of data that you need in order to accommodate your KPIs or the information that you're going to use. So that brings us to the next slide, which actually says, okay, here is where we decided to take our analytics data and really break it down into four pillars. We were looking at wellness, we're looking at sustainability, we're looking at space optimization, we're looking at hospitality. And for us, it was very important because by doing this, we can actually attach almost systems that allow us to put things together. And when I say putting things together is, let's imagine, you know, blood pressure. Blood pressure has a systolic and a diastolic, a higher number and a lower number. They both can be in the green, but if the delta between them is not good, then your blood pressure is bad, which meaning that, you know, we can have X amount of people within our building and the temperature outside is Y, and the air quality within the building is Z. Now you're gonna put them all together. And even though they were in the green before, now we're seeing that there are problems. So it's also important to understand that, why do we have our data? How we're gonna use this data, and then be able to put it together. So for us, this stage of what we call the plasma server, the location where all of our data sits, is where we also create these master tables or this layer of information where we can where we can actually take our access control systems, for example, and in this scenario, I'll tell you, we're using Secure, we're using Breva, we're using Castle Systems, we're using DataWatch, and very soon we're gonna integrate Linnell. How do you now build this tool to grab access data from all these different locations in a dynamic way and also bring them all together into one table that everything looks the same, and then be able to relay that data out into third-party systems on a schedule to be able to match it to your facility management, to your tickets, and then be able to then provide some insight. So as we bring our data in, now we can actually do two things. We can visualize it, and visualization is very, very important. It's the first time that people can actually see data across multiple companies. Your facility management or your operations, your access, asset management or your operations team may be putting reports together where they have three or four different systems because they're spread over multiple states and the systems that they're using are not in all of the states. And now they have to bring all this data together and create reports or create monthly or quarterly or even board level reports, even for certification purposes. It's very difficult to do that. By having your analytics platform be able to produce that for them, that saves a lot of time. It also is the one place where you can see everything from all of your buildings. And then we can talk about automation. Automation can be on a personal level, automation can be on a company level, and automation can be on a building level. On a personal level, you come in, I know you're in the building, I can order the I can call the elevator, I can change the temperature in your room, I can ask you to order coffee in your in the lobby, and all of that just knowing that you're coming into the building. On a company level, temperature outside is 85 degrees. There's 75% of the people within a specific company that I know that when 75% of the people and there's 85%, 85 degrees outside, they usually open up a ticket and they have a problem. So why not already trigger a command to my engineer to change the temperature? So that's on a personal, on a company level, and on a building level, IAQs, air quality control, environmental controls change, and then I can, through KPIs, change it. So I'm running out of time, but I just wanted to do a couple of things. So for example, this is data out of access control, and if you look at that bar chart that looks across access, across time, across the entire portfolio, you can then drill down into a specific customer, and you can even drill down into which doors they actually come in within the building itself to understand their usage of the amenity space. And last is the screen that we look at Okapi, where we feed that data over, and now we can look at trends, we can look at future, and we can extrapolate data and maybe even create some projections on how our service is going to be based on our SLAs, based on access control, based on the facility management information that we're feeding into this system. That's it for me.
Thanks, Elon. And I want to remind everyone who's listening in that if you want to ask questions at any point, please type them into the chat. And I will go through, pick up your questions, make sure they get asked to the right person. So after each speaker, there's going to be a short Q&A, and then will be a longer panel discussion at the end where you guys can submit your questions. So Elon, thanks for the presentation. And one of the things that I'm interested in, so when you go through, how do you figure out, like, how do you work with your business users and decide, like, how do I prioritize who gets the benefits from the data? Because projects all take a long time. What are their needs and how are they going to benefit? Like, how does this go back into the business?
So at the beginning, we were looking, so this is one of the projects where IT had to sell it to the business. So what we did was we looked at pain points that the business has. And like I said, one of the things that we identified was that we have in Boston and in DC, we were using multiple facility management systems. We also had multiple access control systems. And it took somebody anywhere between 1 to 2 days on a monthly basis to compile the report, to have the monthly reports. So we said, well, if we bring all this data together for you and we can produce a report from one place for you, that all you needed to do is just press a button and print out the report the way you wanted to, would that be helpful for you? And they said, absolutely, we want this, we need it right now. And then we went in and we said, okay, what if we do the same thing for other departments? So we started looking into other departments, and as people saw that we're what we can do, they started coming to us and asking us if we can help them using our data.
Yeah, so it was like a, you know, build up over time. As soon as people saw the success, they were really like demanding it.
That's correct.
Yeah. So we have some questions coming in from the audience. You showed some visualizations in your presentation, and they'd like to know what kind of tools you use to produce your visualizations.
So we're moved because our data is decoupled from the actual applications. It allows us to move around a lot between different applications. We're now testing out, and we're moving. So we were using Sisense before. Now we're using Thought. Now we're testing out ThoughtSpot. You know, we were also playing around with a little bit of Microsoft BI. Maybe we'll take a look at Tableau. But the beauty about it is that we don't have to worry about the UI or the final application or the presentation visualization part because the data sits in a completely different layer that allows us to tap in into different to different applications from it and to share it.
Yeah. So in a sense, you're a little bit tool agnostic, which is nice.
That's correct. Yes.
We have one more question. I think I'll save it to the end because I have a starting with, I have a starting with James in a minute, so maybe we can get this. No, I have it starting right now. Okay, so, sorry, I'm having trouble keeping track of the time. So thanks, Elon, for the presentation, and I'm going to introduce our next speaker, and we'll save this question for the panel discussion at the end. Thank you. So James Key is the VP of Data and Architecture at Oxford Properties Group. So as the VP of Data and Architecture, James is focused on establishing several key capabilities that will underpin Oxford's continued global growth objectives. As part of the company's technology modernization, James has established and operationalized a decentralized operating model and team to implement and continuously improve business-driven intelligent automations and digitization. So I'm going to hand it over to James and let him do his thing.
All right. Thanks, Abby. And thank you for having me here today. Looking forward to the discussion. So for today, what I'd like to spend some time on is how we think about advanced analytics. It's a pretty broad topic. So how we decompose it, what is our thinking in terms of advancing it for Oxford Properties, and some of the considerations we have, and you know, happy to go into details into any of the other parts as well. So first of all, right, you know, we've established an advanced analytics team, and our mission is to enable the business to turn every decision into a data-driven decision. So as Abby mentioned earlier, you know, our goal is to actually ensure we understand their business, their needs, and to enable them to make better use of data, right, through analytical techniques. So, and with that, right, the way we visualize analytics is more of a spectrum, right? And, you know, as Elon mentioned earlier as well, right, it does start with data, and we firmly believe in that as well. But then as we go down the spectrum, right, there's areas that we can focus on that's all part of analytics. So systems of record, systems of insight, and system prediction is how we visualize that. And you'll see that it, you know, each of these areas tries to answer the different insights and questions that the business may have. And we're definitely seeing that our business across the board is starting to ask some of these questions, want to see some of these insights. And the problem we're trying to solve as an analytics practice is how do we provide those kind of capabilities, the data, and help them answer some of these questions. And as we advance from system of record, which primarily a lot of times we can do with visualizations, business intelligence tools, as we start moving down and looking at answering questions around systems of insight and prediction, that's where we're seeing that we also need to add additional capabilities to what we're trying to do around AI and machine learning as well. So some of those insights can be driven by machine learning techniques, right, such as clustering, predictive analytics, optimization type of problems and models. And that's what we're starting to look at in terms of from a people, process, and technology standpoint, what do we really need to put in place? Because as you also see on the right-hand side of the slide, there's definitely value and exponential value that we can unlock for our business as we go down the maturity as well, where we're moving from the manual analysis of data down to really augmenting, right, our team and our businesses with additional tools and capabilities that they can leverage to make decisions, right, on behalf of our businesses. So then the question becomes, so how do we power AI machine learning? What do we need to put in place? And I'm going to spend the focus of our discussion today more on the technology side, but you know, absolutely you can't not consider the process and people that goes along with it to make the operating model all work. But in terms of powering it, right, first of all, before we even get to solutions, right, to Abby just mentioned earlier with Elon, we like to look at it, I like to look at it from more of a technology agnostic view first and really break it down into capabilities, right? And yeah, as you see, similar to the other slide, right, if you look at what it takes to build capability around data, systems of record, insights, and prediction, right? And we look at also, right, it's not just about creating something upfront, right? We also need to think about how these products need to be consumed by our businesses, and also how do we operationalize and support it after we have delivered to our business as well. So, you know, one of the things that we're really moving towards and investing in is to allow ourselves and build our technologies and platforms to, you know, scale from just doing proof of concepts and pilots, but really have the foundational in place that we can provide consistent ways for business to consume the analytic outputs, and also having a scalable process and technology in place to operate them at scale as well. As we envision, you know, the demand to quickly increase, we want to make sure that we have a foundational piece in place. So what you'll see here is, yeah, the top bar, I don't think it's anything too, I would say, controversial, right? It's around data. So there's a number of different data. Elon already also, you know, spoke about a number of different areas within just the buildings itself, but beyond that as well, right? There's a lot of public data, external data, internal system data that, you know, our businesses are asking for. And part of it is we need to make that accessible and organized. But beyond that as well, right, there's other capabilities that we, I believe it needs to be in place to really be able to organize it and to advance and to provide some of those insights and deliver some of the capabilities around prediction and leveraging AI and machine learning. So it is a little bit of a building block that you see as we build down. So, you know, we do need a proper data catalog. We need to think about data governance. You know, how do we look at leveraging knowledge graphs, right, to, you know, be able to access our information in a way that allows us to drive models quicker and more accurately, you know, as we move forward. So some of these things we have outlined here are capabilities that really are the building blocks to driving, right, AI and machine learning. But it's not to say that you need to really, you know, check every box before you move to the next layer. And I'll talk a little bit more about that. But this does give us that map to allow us to also figure out where we prioritize, how we sequence and work in an agile manner with our businesses to advance these capabilities while delivering value. And this provides a good framework that we leverage so that we continue to advance these capabilities and move to that, move through that maturity curve. So then the question becomes, how do you actually build those capabilities, right? So we need a data catalog. If we do need, right, a platform to develop and run our models, right? Do you buy or do you build, right? So now that's always a question with any technology, not just in the analytics space. So this is one that we have, right, had many discussions. We want to make sure that this is aligned to our guiding principles on how we want to architect our landscape in the analytics space and technology for Oxford as well. And, you know, what we're seeing over the last year, year and a half, right, you know, it is increasingly complex to navigate the technology landscape. And what we're seeing too is that a blurring of data providers and prop techs, right, that's embedding data and analytical capabilities into their products. So I would say, when I first joined Oxford, there's definitely more of a delineation, right? You can either buy data, right, from a subscription or from a provider. You can buy technology, right? But more and more, we're seeing that blurring, right? So, and they are there to solve very specific problems, which is not a bad thing, in general. But what we found as we have been assessing, working with some of these partners, is that not all of them are architected as end-to-end enterprise analytic platforms. And that is a core consideration for Oxford Properties, because we actually support, a broad base of businesses in pretty much all geographies, all sectors, and across the value chain. So from property management to asset management, right, to offices, to retail, and each of them have their own nuance in terms of what data is required, what insight they're trying to drive, and essentially what we're trying to do is to figure out a way to support all of these businesses without fragmenting a technology landscape to a point that we can't support it. So that's really one of the key problems we're aiming to solve. And part of it is, so what is our approach to address that? And what we have started to do, right, is really establishing more of a foundational enterprise technology stack, and be thoughtful so that we can augment it with third-party solutions to create that flexibility and provide the best-in-class product for our businesses. Because we recognize that our team, right, will have limitations. There are great products out in the market, but if they provide certain solutions to parts of the business, the question becomes, how do we integrate all of that together? What is our approach? And our decision has been to really leverage, right, primarily, especially with a cloud-driven architecture. You'll see that we've start building some, I would say, real estate agnostic technologies that you'll see there, where we're now augmenting that with point solutions as needed. But that gives us that foundation where we could work with different businesses across the board, right? It gives us that flexibility to address different types of use cases and to deliver, right, products and build that engagement and build the value for the analytics practice for Oxford. All right, so hopefully that helps share some of our thoughts in terms of the approach that we have taken, right? Not to say that's the only approach, but given some of the considerations and the problem we're trying to solve at Oxford, hopefully that gives everyone a bit of insight in terms of how we're tackling the problem from a technology standpoint.
Thanks for the presentation, James. And I'd just like to remind everyone, you can ask questions in the chat and they'll get sent over to us. But I'll kick off the questions. When you bring in your third-party data resources, I think what we're finding at RPT is sometimes it makes sense to send people over to use the third-party platform. But then the question is, when does it make sense for us to put in the work to pull in that data so it can be used with our own internal stuff? So how do you balance that line between use an internal platform versus go out to your external third parties?
Yeah, and this is part of the enterprise architecture, right, practice that we're building up as well, so we can assess these consistently, educate our businesses and our technology, right, teams on how to best approach it. But and there's never really a right answer, right? But the considerations that we do take is, is this something that, is it really a competitive advantage to build something in-house, right? I think that's always consideration, and also speed to market, right? Because there is definitely benefits on working with third-party partners who can deliver more features, right? They may have more resources to augment, right? So if it's a point solution that we can deploy, right? And it does solve a key business problem. Those are considerations we'll have and work with our business to say, is this something that we want to implement? So you go through the point solution or the vendor solution to address and get to your business needs. But even if we don't have an initial use case, some of the things that we do look at early on is the integration capabilities, right? So that down the road, if we do want to pull some of that data back, right, we do have a way to do it. So that's one of the, I would say, due diligence that we've started to implement right? So that we don't slow down the business, right? And it gives us that flexibility that we could pull the data back down the road, right? And we kind of have a path towards that if needed.
And so we have a few follow-up questions coming in from the audience. So one is, who's the business champion when you're establishing the enterprise criteria for, you know, the diversification of all these use cases and what the business models are, the end users? How do you go about finding those business champions?
Yeah, so, you know, it really is the various parts of our businesses. So, you know, we've also broken down Oxford into a number of different business areas. So in each of them, we've established essentially champions, right, with our business leaders so that they understand their role, right, and what we can work with them so that what the collaborative model looks like and how we can enable them, right? So part of it is two ways, right? It is partly sometimes it's us providing right insights to our businesses to see, well, what can analytics do? But at the end of the day, right, it's you know, we do want that business champion and the support to say this is solving a real problem that we have, right? So I would say one of the things that we found helpful is actually organizing, exposing data that we have, because a lot of discussion early on has that been that chicken and egg issue, right? So, you know, we go to the business teams and ask, well, what problems do you have with data and analytics? And they say, what can you do for me, right? So, I think where we're able to do is actually organize with what access we have to external data, right? Internal data, right? So we can provide some hypothesis, but also give them a way to actually visualize and see what data we actually have. And then that triggers ideation as well, right? To say, well, we actually have access to all this data. Maybe we can start asking these questions, right? So, you know, that's one of the things that we have done with some of the technologies and platform, right? That's what data catalog, right? Putting our data, you know, centrally so that when they do have a use case, we also have a quick way to actually access that information. So decoupling it from our systems, like what Elon mentioned, is definitely, you know, a lot of the work that's gone in, right? To our what our team is focusing on. And we found that that actually helps accelerate the discussion and make it more of a collaborative discussion versus, hey, you know, just waiting for the business to tell us what they need.
Yeah. So I'm going to take one more question and then we're going to move on to our presentation from Cherry, who's our next presenter. So one of the early questions that came in, so how do you ensure like your data quality when you're going between, first of all, like different platforms, because different platforms can even have a different idea of what different measures are. And then you make sure that it's consistent when it's going into presentations, whether it be, you know, to the board, an external presentation, if it's just purely internal, how do you make sure everyone's on the same sheet of music?
Yeah, it's not an easy problem, right? And we definitely run into some of that as well. So, and this is where, as part of the data platform and engineering team, right, one of the capabilities we are laid out in the earlier slide as well, and we're focused on is establishing what we mean by governance and what is that accountability between the business and technology teams, right? So, and this is something that is still a work in progress on our side. But yeah, having clear definition of what an owner, a steward, right, and what is technology role across, I would say, the data lifecycle, right, is starting to help, right? And some of the things we're starting to pilot and put in place is also, well, you know, if these are certain critical measures, right, and they're governed and everyone enterprise uses it, it goes back to the technology we're putting in place. Well, let's store it centrally so everyone can access it. They're not making up their own measures every single time, right? And creating that, you know, I would say chances of creating errors, even if they pull from the same source system, they could be, you know, calculating it differently, et cetera. So part of the things that we're doing is identifying with the business what are those key measures that's important that we need to govern. Let's put it in a central place and provide, you know, access controls around that. And then what are the things that might be okay that you don't reconcile, right, completely because we're using it for internal management, you know, reporting versus external reporting purpose, like you mentioned, Abby, right? So having agreement around that, right, it's a thing that has helped us progress, right? And we're still putting a lot of that in place right now. And we're also assessing tools that can help us, right, make sure that we do have the audit trail, that it becomes a streamlined process because if the business don't understand how all of this works, right, you know, we're not going to be able to implement this. So I would say at a high level, right, that's something that we've been pushing forward, and we anticipate that's going to be you know, driving value for our businesses in the long run to address that problem.
Thank you, James. I think that was a really great answer to that question. And so I'm going to move on to introducing our next speaker. So we have Ron Beckerman, who's the CTO of Cherry, coming on. So Ron Becker, the CTO of Cherry, he oversees Cherry's emerging technologies. He was formerly with LinkedIn and Salesforce. Ron guides the company's AI-based investment strategy and expansion of its advanced real-time data and analytics platform. So why don't you go ahead and take it away, Ron?
Yeah, thank you very much. So I'll introduce Cherry first. Cherry is in the real estate data integration domain. So as you pretty much all know, I'm pretty sure, to make a real estate investment decision, you need to have access to very many different data sources. And what we do is we take all those sources like GRIS, TREP, Comstock, RCA, many others, including public sources, and we integrate them all together for you. So you tell us which sources you want, we integrate it for you and place it in one platform so you can easily query them. That's a very strong value proposition for very many investors, because as we know, all these data sources are so not connected to each other. And the fact that we connect them, we clean them, we produce them in one source, that essentially makes everyone's life much more easier. But what we do on the way in the back end, we also represent all these sources as the knowledge graph. So today I'm going to be talking about the knowledge graph and one of the use cases at Cherry, how we use the knowledge graph to infer the actual owner of properties. So first of all, what is a graph? Well, depending on where your undergrad degree was, you would look at something like on the left or on the right, and you would say, this is the graph or this is the graph. So I'm a computer scientist. For me, the graph is on the right. So those are circles and lines in between, and circles represent real world entities like people, properties, addresses, companies, etc. And lines between them represent connections between those entities. So this small graph of only two nodes and one edge, one line between, is actually telling a story. And the story is that a person called Tiger Woods used to own a property at this address, but not any longer, because in 2010, this person sold this property. So this tiny graph is already telling a fairly, you know, non-trivial story, but those nodes are connected to many others, and the paths that we're building within this graph are telling more interesting stories. For example, the current owner of the property probably knows Tiger Woods personally, because there is a path between Tiger Woods through that property to that person, and they probably did some transaction together, right? So they signed a contract of a deed. That's why we can infer that those two people know each other. Another example, this property might be kind of similar to the current residence of Tiger Woods, because both of them are connected together through the node of Tiger Woods, right? So if this is a mansion, most probably this is a mansion too. So the more paths we build in the knowledge graph, the more information we can, the more knowledge we can actually construct. So here's how the knowledge graph actually works. The use of the knowledge graph, the main use of it, is to extract hidden information from the knowledge graph. The knowledge graph is built based on multiple data sources. So there is no one single data source that aggregates all this information. it is the knowledge graph that aggregates it. So if we start with a person, a real estate developer, a fairly well-known one, you go to this property, you go to this company, you go to Paul Davies, so you find a connection between Donald Trump and Paul Davies, and this is a connection that is not trivial. It's a hidden connection. No one tells you that those two people are actually connected. They most probably know each other, but if we traverse the knowledge graph, we actually can infer that. And moreover, we can take another pass from Donald Trump to this company, to this address, to the same person. If we see multiple paths between two entities, it makes this connection even stronger. So we can be more confident in saying that those two entities are connected to each other. So at Fieri, we have built the biggest knowledge graph that covers pretty much the entire real estate ecosystem in the United States. It has all the properties, 156 million properties, all the addresses, people, companies, governmental organizations, all of them that are involved in real estate. We have 500 million nodes in our graph and 1.5 billion edges. This is a very big graph, so it's very hard to process it. And here is one of the use cases that we're using the knowledge graph for, which is owner unmasking. So if we have a property and we start traversing the knowledge graph around this property until we reach a node that is an investor, we say, probably it's not a mistake that this investor is so close to this property in the knowledge graph. Probably this investor is the owner of this property. And in many cases, we're actually right. One problem with this approach is that the more you go away from the property, the more nodes you have to process. So the problem is computational. And we solve this computational problem by not starting with the property and looking for the investor, but starting in the middle and going both directions to look for properties and investors. That makes substantially fewer steps on the way, and the algorithm becomes feasible from something that would be very, very difficult to run on a knowledge graph of this size. We bring it down to an algorithm that is actually very much applicable. I guess I'll stop here. Yeah.
Hey, so thanks for walking us through that, Ron. And if there are any questions from the audience, again, feel free to put it in the chat. So, you know, it looks easy when you have it all mapped out in a PowerPoint, but I'm sure it's not as easy as it looks. And like we heard, I think Elon was talking about it earlier, when you have lots of different sources, it's really hard to figure out how do I match them up and what are the things that are the keys, the bridges across these. So what was the hardest part about putting together such a large knowledge graph?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. So it took us 3 years to build a knowledge graph. And the most important problem that we actually solved was data standardization, data normalization. So if you start with like all those various versions of the same name, and you cannot figure out that it's actually the same company, you need to unite it into one node in a knowledge graph, you are in a big trouble. So like, I can ask you a question, like, how many different ways to write the name of JP Morgan you can see in the data? Just throw me a number.
Probably 100.
25,000.
That's way higher than I thought.
Different ways to write JP Morgan, which includes every subsidiary, every typo, every branch of Chase Bank with the name of the town, without the name of the town, with a typo in the name of the town, anything you can imagine would be out there. If we put 25,000 different nodes in the knowledge graph for the same company, JP Morgan, this knowledge graph is useless. So this is the biggest trouble that we solved, and we are very proud of our solution.
Yeah, that's I think one of the hardest problems that a data professional has, is especially with like Word data that doesn't have numbers in it, so challenging. So we have another question that came in from the audience. So what are some of the key success factors to successfully implement your knowledge graph solution?
Yeah, so measuring the quality of the knowledge graph is a big trouble. It's pretty much, we don't have a good solution for that, but we build analytics applications on top of the knowledge graph, and honor unmasking is one of them. So we can, having some level of ground truth data, we actually can evaluate the honor unmasking system. And as we evaluate our system, we can go down to the level of the knowledge graph to see whether we can see some type of problems in the knowledge graph that caused problems in honor unmasking. So it's kind of a downfall from the actual application to the level of the infrastructure that we built.
So we have one more question from the audience before we move on to our next speaker. And I think this might be related to what you were just talking about. So they're asking, if you're pulling data from disparate sources, how do you verify the data quality? Although it does sound like the knowledge graph helps with that piece of it.
Yeah, so the right way of verifying the data quality is what we call triangulation. If the same connection between two nodes is coming from different sources, we trust this connection substantially more than if it's just one source that's connecting those two nodes. And eventually, as we see more data, we see more and more triangulated connections, and we have much more trust in our knowledge graph as we go.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So I want to ask three people and have them give me the same answer instead of just asking one.
Exactly.
All right, thank you, Ron. I think that was a really great presentation. And so our next company is Brainbox, and see, I know that they have a little video for us to watch before I go into the introduction of the speaker, so I'm gonna let the video play.
Buildings around the world can now tackle one of their greatest challenges, the inefficient energy usage of heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. Using the most advanced artificial intelligence technology, Brainbox AI connects rapidly and securely to autonomously learn your building's unique characteristics, making continuous adjustments to each component of your entire HVAC system, while reducing building energy consumption by up to 25% and carbon footprint by 20 to 40%. Now, imagine the global impact.
So I'm going to introduce our speaker from Brainbox, Jean-Simon Ben. He is a tech expert who thrives on developing and implementing new technology to solve long-standing commercial issues. He has over 25 years of experience in the fields of telecommunications, biotechnology, and energy efficiency with an industrial engineering background. Jean-Simon, I'm going to hand it over to you now.
Thank you, Abigail. Just want to make sure that my sound is coming loud and clear. So today I want to give you like a very short snapshot on, if you use a deep learning tool like the neural network and you combine it with multi-objective algorithm, how can you generate more value with all of that data that James, Elan, and Abigail and Ron describe? That is becoming available more and more. So if you look at the field of how do people right now apply deep learning, which is a subset of the different AI family of techniques, and you're all familiar with computer vision, I think we hear about it every day on the media, speech recognition, drug design or drug discovery, but also controls. And I think the most famous one is the autonomous car. Autonomous trucks, semi-trailer, autonomous which are really using these deep neural network, crunching the data at a very, very fast pace to find out what is the optimal decision that they need to take within milliseconds or within minutes. And that field of control is evolving very, very rapidly today. So if you look at that field of deep learning applied to control, and you look more into like the HVAC control, which is, you know, somewhere 40 to 70% of the energy consumption of a commercial building, you're looking at the recipe that is really divided in three pillars. The first pillar is you need to extract that data. And there was a lot of discussion in this webinar about how do you extract the data? How do you clean the data? How do you make that data readily available? So once you manage to do that, and this is the fuel of any application in deep learning. So if you don't do that step, you're basically nowhere. You're not gonna create any value. The second pillar, it's all about using that data, and this is kind of a twofold approach. The first one is using these deep learning technique, similar than the autonomous car, to predict what will be happening. So you need to define what is the immediate future. And in the HVAC world, immediate future is probably the next 6 hours. So you want to know what will be happening on the HVAC operation of that building for the next 6 hours. And you want it to be like super precise. So if you can know with a precision of 99%, what exactly will be the room temperature in every of the zone in the building, and how is the system will react to the different event happening in that building at a very precision, at a high precision, then you basically know the future. And then the big question is, okay, now that I know the future, I mean, how can I find a better control strategy than the one that will unfold if you don't do anything? So can you change that future for a better future? What is the optimal control strategy? So it sounds like easy, all right, I'm gonna try to save money, right? But really it's a multi-objective discussion, and I'm gonna show you a different layer of what do I mean by multi-control. And once you figure out that you might have a new control strategy which could do some better job than the existing one that will happen if you don't do anything in that building, then you have to find a way to write it back to that building without disrupting any of the existing operation. And that is the third pillar. So really, this is the recipe. It's 1, 2, 3. Now, I mentioned, you know, you want to do this. Why should you go through the trouble of doing all this? Because you're really creating a lot of value. And it's quite fascinating how much value you could create by applying these type of techniques. So you want to basically make the comfort in the environment like a more agreeable, like more less comfort issue, if I should say, for the occupant, for the tenant. So all of these areas where it's a bit too cold, a bit too hot at certain moments during the day, you want to reduce these events that which are not desirable in the operation of the building. You want to reduce the energy being consumed. At the same time, you will also reduce the emission, but you also want to operate the equipment in a smoother fashion, because if you operate these equipment in a smoother fashion, you might prolong their lifespan and delay that CapEx investment that you're going to have to do for certain of these equipment. And that equation is what I call the multi-objective control. So you want to optimize the thermal comfort. You want to optimize the power, which you know, if you create the super peak of power, you will be punished at the end of the month by the utility, because they don't like you to create power event. So you want to reduce them. You want to reduce the sheer quantity of energy you're going to use. You want to reduce the cycling of equipment. You want to reduce your costs. And while you're at it, well, let's reduce the CO2 emission at the same time. And you could play with these objectives by putting them equally weighted or putting more emphasis in one of these objectives, and then asking the algorithm to try to optimize that equation in real time, so you could take control of the building and write back and get some of the benefit that you were expecting. So it's very flexible in terms of what you're trying to accomplish. So if we look at what it could create in terms of value, I give you that very simple example where we took a typical retail environment with a rooftop, which are driven by a thermostat in the room. So you could imagine that There is several rooftop feeding that big open space of a retail. And we ask the AI, say, well, try to optimize the temperature in terms of comfort. So stay within that comfort band, reduce the energy, reduce the power peak that you might create. And please do not cycle the equipment or as less as possible. So when you just run that system and you say with only one RTU, here's what happens. So the AI, the deep learning and that multi-objective algorithm is trying to beat the existing control sequence in the building. And a side-by-side comparison kind of show you that with one RTU, one zone, one thermostat, it's trying to optimize the situation. And in this case, it managed to reduce the number of minutes that you were out of that comfort band. So it was clearly doing a good job on that. Didn't do much on the power factor, managed to reduce a kilowatt hour and actually reduce the number of minutes that the equipment is being run. So it's trying to work on that cycling. And what you look at the command control, what it gives you, it's kind of creating a new command signature and this side-by-side comparison in the existing control sequence and the AI sequence. So you start to see it's adopting a different behavior in terms of how does it operate the equipment. So that's one RTU. So now I'm going to jump to, let's compare with this retail where there has seven RTU on a rooftop, and they're driven by seven thermostat. So asking the AI, okay, now operate all seven in parallel, and then suddenly you start to see a lot of value being created. So manage to improve the comfort, to reduce drastically the power factor, reduce the kilowatt hour, manage to reduce a lot of cycling and the cost, having a huge impact. So imagine if it was an office tower of 50 floors with all of the zone, it just start to bring more and more value as it creates synergy impact in the decision, because it's basically analyzing all of it in parallel in real time, which is very hard to do us as human. Even if we have a huge spreadsheet doing pivotal table, it will be very hard to do in real time. So that's the power of AI when you have the data. So Abigail, it's back to you.
Thanks, Sean Simone. So we do have some questions from the audience that came in that are a little bit more vendor specific, and we like to keep these talks a little bit more technical focused, but I'm sure if you have some questions about how your company can integrate BrainBox AI, I bet if you reach out to Jean Simone after the webinar, he'll connect you with the right people to answer your questions.
Absolutely.
With the technical portion, so you go through a lot of how you guys use deep learning as your primary like AI algorithm to solve this problem, but did you work through trying to use any of the other like big names, so like gradient boosted machines, random forest, that get used in maybe a lot of other areas?
Yeah, we tried at the beginning when we did a lot of exploration of how do you apply, you know, these different techniques and what value can you generate. So we did random forest a lot at the beginning, mostly on the mapping, trying to figure out, can we automate the mapping of that data coming in? Because as you know, it's when it's coming out of the control system of the HVAC, it is very messy and very dirty in terms of data. So we need to figure out how can you map it, how can you tag it, so it could be useful somehow. So we try these techniques, but on the prediction of predicting how the temperature, let's say, will fluctuate in a given zone over the next 6 hours, tool like the LSTM on the neural network were really like the best fit. They give you that accuracy. And it's interesting because when you think about it, at the end of the day, that zone become characterized quite rapidly. So that zone will always behave the same way under a certain condition. So either weather condition outside or inside condition. And it's very predictable once you figure out what are the feature which is driving that zone. The problem is the next zone on the other side of the building is probably driven by another feature which got nothing to do with that. So that's how you really need to characterize each of your neural network per zone and that become your building block. And then you could aggregate all of these predictions together. So that's so far, it was really the best fit on our side.
So we have a question in from the audience. So you're using these deep neural networks to integrate with real building systems. So they want to know, can you share any insights about how that works, how you go into control system integration, and how do you work within the real estate industry when, you know, you have long-term agreements? What happens if some of those agreements change? How do you put in those ROIs when you go back into the business for something like this model, which, again, it's technical, so it can be very difficult to understand for people who maybe aren't as technical?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's numerous challenge, and I think you covered, and James and Elan, a lot of that point is when we connect to a building, the data is dirty. We discover all kind of equipment which are not working properly. So if it's garbage in, garbage out, there's not much you could do when things are not working the way they should, and it's not properly organized. So that is like a huge barrier. But I would say then it's a question of what protocol is being used in that building and how efficient is that control system. So very old control system, you could try to write back, but they have their own speed and you cannot exceed that speed. So you have to follow that speed. And when I was talking about these three pillars, very often people think that the most difficult pillar was the AI and the multi-objective control. It was not. Actually, it was the easiest pillar. The two very hard pillar was, how do you connect to an existing building which has an old system which is really needs some upgrade, but they don't do the upgrade, and how can you read that data without creating problem to that existing system? And then the third pillar, how can you write back without creating problem? Because that's last thing you want to do. So you really, really have to be very careful how you get that harmony on these two pillars. And I think that's the biggest challenge that you're facing.
Yeah, it's how do you prove out that you're not just going to all of a sudden break the air conditioner and then everyone's like, it's 95 degrees in here, I am unhappy.
And it's all about safety, right? It's similar than your autonomous car. How can you evaluate that the decision that we're about to write back? So we think we have a new control strategy. This is great. We think it's optimized and we're about to write back. You need to have other algorithm which is going to look into that decision before you're writing back to vet it. And we put in place these three judges, independent judges, which are evaluating the decision under certain principle. And they all three have to say yay before you're allowed to write back, because the last thing you want is to break that boiler, right?
Mm-hmm. So we have another question in from the audience. So do you receive pushback from your facilities engineers if they don't want to have a third party system without their input approval? So how do you manage that, like automated versus, you know, manual control?
It's the pushback that we sometimes get, it's all about human, right? So you've been operating that building with your BMS, with your screen, you've been overriding some of the point, you're doing your thing, right? And suddenly we're coming and we tell you, no, the AI will not operate it. You're gonna have full visibility and you have this big button that you could release the AI if you feel that it's worth it. But you should start to trust that AI. And it's a similar problem they have, and I keep giving that analogy in autonomous car because I know a lot of people working in that field. I mean, it's the trust issue. I mean, it's the number one limitation factor in the autonomous car. Building that trust in between the human and the algorithm, which is driving the car instead of you, it's the number one challenge. It's also a challenge in the HVAC and the BMS world. Like we need to build that trust, that people trust that the AI is doing the right thing. And very often we have customer calling us and say, the AI right now is opening that damper. I don't understand why. I mean, should I push my brake button, right? And then we have to look into it. And say, no, it's look, there's logic. There's a reason why it's doing it. And here's why we think, yeah, it's exactly the reason. And then people say, oh, okay, so it makes sense now. But the stress of not understanding why the AI is taking that decision.
Yeah, I get that a lot. So I worked in security at General Motors, and that was one of the things that we talked about that like quite a bit, and how do you build in, you know, the safeties in the background and have dual systems. So if one system breaks, you have something else there to pick it up. So that's
we actually have more safeties than we have, you know, optimization control in place. So which is kind of weird, right?
Always makes sense when you're dealing with a physical system.
Yeah.
So I think I don't have any other questions coming in from the audience. It would be a good time to move into the panel discussion. So to invite Elon, James, and Ron to come back on with us for the next probably about 25 minutes. Hi. So I had actually a question for Elon right at the beginning, and so I'm going to go back through the audience questions we didn't get answers to. And I think this came up again with James, it came up with Ron. So it's, you know, how are you finding the business sponsorship? How do you guys define what are the key success factors that help you sell the value of data analytics when you're going into here are these new products that are coming on board?
I'll take it first. So we started out by introducing it to our operations and trying to help them with reporting. But then the business, you know, our sustainability team started looking at how do we create a lower carbon footprint. Then, as well as providing reports to different associations that that we're members of today. So they were the ones that came back and said, okay, can you help us? How can we now look and visualize data and bring more information, start processing data much better? So they were our second team that we were looking at. And now I think that we're getting the buy-in out of our executive and out of our management too, because it provides them a lot of insights, and instead of having to go and ask for the information, they can go in and look at it by themselves. So I think that that was sort of like the way we were looking at it, and we're trying to add systems all the time. We're trying to add, and what we're trying to do is align with the business requirements. If hospitality and customer service is the key component, then who do we partner with today that can leverage our data and provide us some AI, machine learning, and projections, and analyze our data and give us a solution for better customer service and better hospitality? And that's how we're sort of like selling it, where we're selling the end result. But when they say, yeah, we really like this, then we go back and we say, okay, now we need to collect and we create these data sets or join these data sets together.
Anybody else want to add on to what Elon was just saying?
I would say maybe too, right? It's what Elon mentioned earlier too. It is around also establishing, right? You know, what are kind of those outcomes we're looking for? I think that has been key, right? Agreeing on what problem we're trying to solve. And like Elon mentioned, right, and take steps, right? I think that's the other thing too, right? It's better to learn along the way. I think that's also bringing that awareness and that, you know, agility, right? We talk about agility with our business partners in the analytics space. That's what kind of I think about, right? It is, we'll learn along the way. We'll find issue with data. We'll find issue with technology, but how do we continue to progress? And even if we don't get 100% of the way there, right, I think, you know, even being able to advance, right, and help the business solve some of the problems, and they understand what's working, what's not, right, and has been a helpful way to build that engagement as well with our businesses and the sponsorship, right, that, you know, we're not going to deliver perfection, right, up front because there's so many unknowns, but by partnering and working together, I think we've found that, you know, we've gotten a lot of great input and we're building better solutions at the end of the day.
Yeah, and I would think from some of the questions I've seen coming through, like Ron and Jean-Simon, you see a different side of that, right? So like Jean-Simon is about, you know, how do we put in these manual overrides and how do you make people feel comfortable with technology? And I think Ron, we had some questions in about like how does the business figure out even how to use the knowledge graph? Like what about it is helpful. And so like you're coming from the opposite side, right, where you guys have to sell like what your solution is. And like James and Elon and I, since we sit in the business, we're selling, but we have a completely different motivation because we're also like cooperating with the business. And so I don't know if Ron or Jean-Simon, if you have anything you'd like to add from your perspective.
Yeah, totally. We really have to learn from our customers. The technology can be used in zillions of different ways, especially once we lay down the foundation of the technology, which is the knowledge graph. Like there are so many applications that can be built and we have to prioritize. And our priorities are our customers. Whatever our customers need first, we will do that for them. And obviously enough, we have like a long list of solutions that we would like to build, but the prioritization is totally coming from the customer.
Jean-Simon, do you have anything?
No, I'm not much to add on what was said. I think Ron is exactly at the same place. It's you have to limit yourself to a sandbox, otherwise it's kind of infinite, right? We're already under pressure to include, because right now we're doing like, you know, energy optimization, comfort optimization, cycling optimization, but now we have customers saying, hey, we would like to do emission optimization. And then we return back and say, okay, but is emission optimization as important as cash optimization, like money optimization? I mean, or are they equal? And it creates all kind of discussion. And at the end, you still need to do an optimization what's going to work, right? So it's a fascinating subject, but kind of infinite discussion.
And I think on that topic of, you know, data can be a thing that gets out of control really quickly. Somebody from the audience wants to know, like, how much change management and education do you really have to put in it to executing it? I mean, they say a typical agile implementation project. I always feel like data projects are more never ending than maybe some other types of IT projects. And like, how do you plan out like a typical implementation for a data product? So how do you decide when it's done? And then like, I'm complete and now I'm gonna get to the next step. And what's that next step? And I know that's something that we're talking about a lot at RPT. So I don't know if you guys wanna weigh in on how you guys work with that within your own organizations.
I can take it. Yeah, in our world, we have to move fast for sure and come up with a solution as fast as we can, put it in front of our customers, test it. So for our own unmasking, that actually that's what we did. Our competitive advantage over other companies is that we actually have a very good coverage. We covered pretty much all the properties in the United States. We put it out there and the first customer tested the Empire State Building and found a mistake. And we're like, okay, now what? So it turns out that, like, you know, if you take care of every single data point equally, you might surprise someone who is interested in some type of a small building somewhere out there, but you might really annoy someone who cares about the Empire State Building and One World Trade Center and stuff like that. So what we figured out is that we need to have a layered approach to actually take care of the head of this distribution, right? Those properties that really matter to really, really many people. So that's what we're doing right now. We kind of split this entire distribution of properties to the head, the body, and the tail. We take care of the body and the tail already, but we are not really good at the head. And really many companies care that much about the head of this distribution. So that's what we're doing right now. So it's a layered approach.
It's like the 80-20 rule, right? So 20%
exactly.
is responsible for 80% of value. Mm-hmm.
Totally. Mm-hmm.
For us, it was more of a building a cycle. So we did not introduce multiple data sets at once. We brought in one data set at a time, and we created a cycle of how to process the data and understand it, validate. So, you know, bringing it, identifying it, validating it, implementing it, visualizing it, then confirming that it's actually giving us what we're expecting to see. And then we would start the cycle all over again with a brand new set of data. And as you add more pieces of data, the cycle becomes faster and faster, but you're introducing new data sets one at a time. And then once you have all these data sets, the cycle can become, and how do we start layering them? And how do we start analyzing them? And then how do we start automating them? But the idea is that we look at a cycle and we build the different cycles with process that everyone, all the subject matter experts own. And then that way we sort of like, we complete it and then we start all over again.
Always I think always the hard part for me, like when you get to the end too, it's I finished this and now I have to keep maintaining it as well and start another project because the business wants it. So that's always a balancing act. Doing all of those things. And I don't know if James or Jean-Simon, you have anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I would say, right, that's a problem we're starting to definitely run into as well, right, is to, well, it's one thing to build something, right, but I think supporting, right, something continuing to build, right, is something that we're very mindful of. And that's one of the reasons why, right, we're investing in even automation, right, and other things and scripting, right, within our own teams, right, and agreeing on what the operating model like, what does the business own going forward, right, versus technology, right, within the data team or, our support teams, right? So I do think that the operating model is shifting in the analytic landscape, and that's one of the things that we're discussing within our organization as well, right, because I do think that especially when we start talking about machine learning and other techniques, right? If we're going to monitor accuracy or we have to continually train the data sets, right? Some of that will be responsible on the business. And that's something that's kind of foreign, right? Because they look at it as technology. Of course, technology is going to own this, right? But I think that's some of the things that as we drive the discussion, we have a better way of articulating and seeing where the resource constraints are and how we address it. But I think that's definitely right, a shift in thinking, right? And I do think there's a lot of things that we could do as a analytics group that could minimize a lot of the work, but not gonna completely eliminate, right? So building pipeline, right? Automating deployments, right? Using DevOps practices, right? Some of those things we put in place has really helped. But at the end of the day, there's certain changes, right? That I think it's gonna be a change management exercise as well.
Yeah, and some of the things that I've talked about with my colleagues is like sometimes when you take work and switch it to a different department, you're not necessarily reducing the work, you're just moving it around to different places. So, automation can help with that somewhat, but there are still pieces that are going to be manually operated too. Always a consideration. Jean-Simon, did you have anything to say about change management?
Yeah, absolutely. So you deliver that project, right? You think everything is mm-hmm. done. It goes in production. What do we call this new term, which is the AI ops, right? So you have the stream of data coming every 5 minutes from your building and everything is fine. And then suddenly somebody in the building changing equipment. So that data set get disrupted because there's some of the data that you don't receive anymore. So how do you deal with that? I mean, do you just stop the entire building modulation or you just stop that floor or that subsegment of the, and then they replug a new equipment when there's new point coming in, which are not the same than the previous one, because of course it's a different equipment. It's got more point probably. And then you need to remap, retag, and re-inject into the configuration. So if that start to happen on a regular basis and you have 100 building to do, it's a workload that need to be done and managed on an ongoing basis. And if you don't, everything's gonna go sideways, right? So it's a new field, right? New field, that pipeline data stream that you need to manage. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, how do you like fail soft so you don't break everything, but you do get the warning that you need to come in and do something. We had another question in from the audience that was about cybersecurity. So how does cybersecurity come into when you guys are starting to build out AI implementations. And, you know, Elon and James talked a lot about building out just like your data infrastructure and how that comes in. So is this a big concern for you guys within the real estate industry? How do you think about that affecting your data projects?
We actually at CAR, we built a 2.5 years ago, we started an asset cybersecurity program where we did some audits, did audits of our buildings, but then built a full infrastructure that is associated with asset cybersecurity, anywhere from converged network, policies and procedures, training our engineers, addressing all of the different networks within the building itself, providing security from network analyzers, network traffic analyzers, as well as endpoint solutions in the buildings themselves. We even have language that goes into our providers' agreements that addresses them conforming to the requirements that we talk within the building. But it's very, very big, because where before IT never really had a touch into the building, the building systems and into those components, now we are actually responsible for everything, because Siemens will come in and throw a computer and say, this is your computer from now on. We will do everything for you on it, but this is yours. It's your problem. So remote access, all of those things, password management, all of that had to be put in order to defend it. And as we're building on the IoT and the sensors and everything to gather all this different types of information and talking to these different systems, it plays a big role for to protect it.
Yeah, I would say that's similar to what we have been doing at Oxford as well, right? It is standardizing, creating a reference architecture for a building, because it has been so fragmented in the past, but and also being able to manage it more centrally, even though the buildings are separate. One of the things is a lot of that data is flowing back and forth between other systems now, right? So I think it opens up a lot of the different threat vectors, right? And those are the ones that we need to really be mindful of, right? It's just new, I would say, risks that we haven't had encountered in the past. And there's a lot more bigger implications, right? As some of these threat vectors now can impact other systems within our corporation as well, not just at a building level, right? So that's one of the areas we are, right? Having defined architecture on how we want to architect this consistently across our buildings. I would say the other thing too, right, is around, you know, we've also been engaging with our data privacy, right? Teams as well, right? To make sure that as we go through these AI projects, right, from a security perspective, from a privacy perspective, right, we engage them early on so that we also understand the risk and back to, you know, how do we continue to move forward, right, with our businesses, right, understand where the risks are and address them as we move forward. So, you know, that's been driving some good conversation, but partly it's we don't want to slow everything or grind to a halt because, you know, there's all these risks, but how do we manage them? How do we address them, right? And continue to move forward, understanding what those implications are.
And I would say, I bet John Simon runs into that a lot more than some of the others, since he is, you know, putting his AI solution directly connected into the HVAC systems. So do you guys go in and like consider how do you build out the cybersecurity? How do you make sure your models can't be, you know, hacked into and changed?
Yeah, the cybersecurity is usually the biggest discussion before you start implementing with the customer. We have our cloud that's easy to secure, but that connection to that building, making sure that it's going to be super tight and that we're not going to create any hole for somebody else to exploit and to go into that building because we're connecting to it. It's usually where we're going to spend the most time to figure out how we're going to connect to that building and making sure that the customer is on top of it, that we're on top of it, and we're super harmonized together. So, you know, huge team internally on our side. I would say it's as important as the algorithm themselves.
Yeah, and that's, I think, something in the cybersecurity industry that I know people are keeping an eye on is some of these deep learning models. It's possible to fake the algorithm out to have it predict different things than you would want it to. So imagine that's something you guys are keeping an eye on too. see Sarah has joined us. I don't know if Ron wanted to chime in on that cybersecurity or Sarah needs to call
us. I just want to say a word. We are very lucky. We are 100% cloud-based, which makes our life much easier. We are SOC 2 compliant, and what we really care about is to make sure that the data of our customers that we keep is safe. And also, since we're a data aggregator, we make sure that our customers receive the data that they need, and the data is not mixed up in the middle of the process. So this is our main focus: security of third-party data and not mixing up different data sources in a way that might expose some private data to those parties who are not supposed to see them.
Thanks, Ron, and I'll pass it over to Sarah.
Thank you so much, Abby, and great job facilitating the discussion. I really enjoyed today's webinar. I thought it was very helpful for the audience. Really appreciate all the panelists sharing their insights with you guys. And also, of course, appreciate the audience for joining us, taking time out of their, I'm sure, busy schedules to be with us today. If you missed part of the webinar, again, the session was recorded and we will be sending out a copy of the recording within the next few days. And then we also have another webinar coming up on a similar topic. We will be talking about data and data strategy in a couple of weeks when we talk about how data is facilitating the return to work and the new now normal back in the office. So we'll talk about that in a couple of weeks. And then tomorrow, I want to invite you to join us for our RealCom Live episode with Ray Wang at Constellation Research. And with that, I want to wish everyone a wonderful rest of your day. Thanks again for joining us.
Thanks, Sarah. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.